my lecture into two classes, just because I don't want to speed through it. And my speaker for next week has the flu, like half the institute right now. So.
The closest, I had the flu for 2 weeks to cancel classes and everything.
Now, actually, Joe Terrio's still alive because Joe's going to be lecturing next.
Oh, it's serious.
They just said that.
No, it's a pretty serious problem.
Yeah, in Florida and New York City.
So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some of the subspecialty testing we do that's really quite important on our hemolignancy side. Now, later in the semester, you're going to hear more about the specifics of hemolignancies, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of information. How many of you are taking the cancer pathology class? Is there anybody here? Okay, so you're going to hear a little bit more about that next week from me, and I think Dr. Terrio's lecture will overlap a little bit. So we've got four people. How large is that class, by the way?
Eight
people? Okay. This way I know how many copies of things to make. All right, so how many chromosomes do we have? Let's see. 46. We've known we've had 46 chromosomes since 1956, which, given in the big scheme of things, is really not a long time. We've talked about chromosomes in different organisms. People who are doing plant studies first observed chromosomes in the mid-1800s. Mitosis was described in salamander. The actual term chromosome was coined by von Waldeyer. It was postulated that chromosomes carried the genomic material, and as I said before, 1956 for 46 chromosomes. So that's 22 pairs of autosomes and the two sex chromosomes. A very creative German line drawing that shows what could be described as chromosomes. We have a big history of studying chromosomes here at Roswell Park. So let's back up a little bit to 1956. People were interested in looking at individuals who were dysmorphic, meaning that they look different in some way. And they studied a peripheral blood from individuals with Down syndrome and discovered that there was an extra copy of chromosome 21. Individuals with Klinefelter syndrome, XXY, women who had Turner syndrome were either missing one of the copies of the X or there were structural abnormalities of one of those copies of the X chromosome. And the types of changes that they visualized were seen in all the cells of the body. It's a rare occurrence where you do not have these abnormalities in all the cells. So most of these are meiotic events. So these are events that are occurring in the egg and the sperm. There are some post-meiotic events that can lead to mosaicism or a mixture of normal or abnormal cells. But those events are much rarer. What we're going to talk about today and Tuesday are chromosome abnormalities that are acquired as part of the disease process. So the types of changes that I'm going to be talking about are going to be limited to the malignant cell population. So that's the first thing that you need to consider. It gets a little dicey sometimes when you have an individual who has an acquired chromosome abnormality and then picks up or acquires other changes. Best example of that would be an individual with Down syndrome. The kids have a 20-fold increased risk of developing leukemia. So we're always asking our clinicians to make sure they let us know, because you can acquire an extra copy of chromosome 21 in addition to having one. And those studies that were done on those individuals were performed on peripheral blood that was stimulated. It was stimulated to grow, because if you look at a normal cell cycle, the phase that we're most interested in is the mitotic phase. And the cells that are circulating are mostly T cells. They are in G0. So they need to be tickled or stimulated into proliferation. And we do that by adding a compound called PHA, phytohemagglutinin. So that would be used for constitutional studies. Any cell that can divide in culture is fair game for us to do a conventional chromosome analysis. So can anybody remember the stages of mitosis? Okay, interphase is when the cell is not in division. It spends most of the time in interphase. So the order would be prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. So it's going to be this stage right here. Whoops, sorry about that. It's going to be this stage right here in C where the chromosome is most condensed. So I don't want to spend too much time on chromosome composition. You had a little bit of that in the first semester. We're talking about DNA, lots of DNA. When I do these talks for middle school students, I usually walk in with a piece of string that's about a yard and a half long. And that's about the amount of DNA that's in one of the chromosomes. So they at least have a visual for that. And it's a lot of higher order packing with the DNA. We recognize the chromosomes by their banding pattern. And that banding pattern is actually induced onto the chromosome by a dip of the slide and some trypsin. So what appears to be a barcode is unique to each of the chromosomes. Have any of you done that exercise when you were in maybe high school or college where you actually cut the chromosomes out? It's incredibly tedious, wasn't it? That's how we did it 20 years ago. We have some toys in the laboratory that I'm going to show you. Since you can't visit the lab, I'll show you some of the things that we can do. So this is as much a technical lecture as it is a theoretical lecture and an application lecture. There will be a take-home question that I'm going to hand out to you guys on Tuesday that will ask you guys to delve into the literature a little bit. Because I want you to have a practical understanding when you read the literature of what exactly that numerical set of numbers might mean for you. So we always orient the chromosomes, by the way, with the short arm up. A lot of this is by convention. Each chromosome is composed of two sister chromatids that are joined by the centromere. The centromere has repetitive sequences that are unique that will help us identify the chromosomes later on in our discussion. So by convention, they call the short arm the P arm and the long arm the Q arm. This was all done probably in the 50s. And there were some discussions on our cytogenetic listserv as where did P and Q come from? And if you think of the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, the formula has the P's and Q's. So they were always thinking that they were trying to be mathematical about it. A good way for you to remember is that P stands for petite or short. So it's your short arm. So when we always think of our chromosomes, that's the way we're always going to be orienting them. Now, if I gave this talk about 10 or 15 years ago, I probably would have told you that the estimated genetic constitution was 100,000 genes. Human Genome Project really informed us, and it's probably less than 30,000. It's probably between 20 and 25,000. The size of an average chromosome band that we would be looking at is about 3 million base pairs of DNA. The size of an average gene is about 5 times 10 to the 4th DNA base pairs. So I'm involved in a technique that is really very gross inspection of the DNA. In a sense, it's really a low-resolution scan of your genome. And it's on a single-cell basis. And that's where the power comes for us when we're trying to evaluate the complexity of what's going on in a patient. before the 1970s, this is what people looked at. There were no bans on the material. If you looked at the literature, people had spent a lot of time measuring the length of the arms of the chromosomes. We're very fortunate human chromosomes come in different shapes and sizes. And if you take the time, there are 46 chromosomes there. Those chromosomes where the centromere is in the center are called metacentric chromosomes. When the centromere appears off-center, they're submetacentric. And when they appear just at the end of the chromosome, we call those acrocentric. Some of the older literature calls those telocentric chromosomes. If you're a mouse, you'd have 40 chromosomes, and they would all look like this. So they're much more difficult to study. Now, I'm pointing to this guy over here because we're going to come back to this chromosome here that was noted in material that wasn't banded. I just want to give you a feel for how material is processed in the laboratory. I'm sure Dr. Bogner talked to you about processing samples in pathology. These are labor-intensive tasks. In the case of cytogenetics, slides are dropped individually. There's very little automation, especially if you're studying bone marrows the way we do. We will, for our leukemia and lymphoma patients, depending on the diagnosis, bone marrow is usually the sample that we would like to study best because that's where the disease is for these particular patients. It's in the long bones, so invariably they will do a biopsy and an aspirate of bone marrow from the back of the iliac crest, and they'll pull out milliliters worth of bone marrow. The first pull would go to the hematopathologist because that's the most cell-rich pull, and then the rest of the material is kind of pooled and it's shared among a group of laboratories. We'll get a sample, flow cytometry, we'll get a sample, molecular diagnostics, and we have a procurement laboratory that actually will freeze down material that could be then used for different projects. So there's a lot of coordination of effort. And these samples have to be taken as the patient is diagnosed. Many of the acute leukemias present as medical emergencies. So the patient needs to be treated, usually with the chemotherapeutic agent within 24 hours of presentation. So you don't get any do-overs when you're working with clinical samples. And I'm sure Dr. Bogner could, you know, describe to you the same sort of thing. This is the process in a nutshell. We count our cells. They're cultured in RPMI 1640. Anybody doing any lab work yet? Tissue culture?
Yep.
What are you culturing?
I have quite a few cells, but I do use RPMI 1640 for LNCAP.
So. Oh, you're using the LNCAP. Okay. Just as a sideline, Dr. Leong was involved in characterizing those cells initially, when they were first established. So if you have any questions about LNCAP, she would be a good resource for you. Does anybody know the history behind RPMI 1640? Pardon?
Yeah, Rosa Fox Medical.
And Rob, like a nonprofit status?
Well, in the 1960s, things were, you know, a lot looser. George Moore was institute director at the time, and he was interested in growing cells. And, you know, you didn't have molecular techniques, so you had to have a lot of cells to do your biochemical studies. So they're very interested in expanding out cell populations. And the formulation 1640 was the one that worked the best. And you can look it up online to see what's in it. RPMI stands for Roswell Park Memorial Institute, which was the name of the place when I came here. Some people who used to work in the labs here started a small distribution laboratory in Grand Island, became Grand Island Biological Company, which, you know, if you go through multiple iterations, is now part of Thermo Fisher, and they have a massive complex on Grand Island. But the RPMI 1640 is sold through the Gibco brand, Grand Island Biological Company, because that's how most people remembered it. And with that name recognition, they've probably sold more 1640 than anybody else. So tissue culture is really an art. You're using 1640. How much serum?
10% serum.
Okay. We're using close to 20% serum because we want our cells to just get a boost into cell division. They're only going to divide once or twice before we go into our analytic phase with them. So the cells are grown overnight, 37 degrees, 5% CO2. We do what we call a mitotic arrest before we start our quote-unquote harvest procedure. The mitotic arrest actually is the addition of a compound called colsemid. You have that on the screen. Colsemid interacts with the tubulin in the spindle fibers that are attaching to the centromere that would be pulling the chromatids apart as the cells transition from metaphase to anaphase. So it's very convenient. It helps us enrich the number of cells that might be in division. None of these cells are synchronized in any way. So we're normally setting up our cells at a concentration of about 1 million cells per mil. We have 10 mil flasks, and we usually do triplicates. And all those cells are all over the cell cycle. We can't predict how quick the proliferation might be from patient to patient, so we just have to kind of average things. One of the drawbacks to counting the number of chromosomes prior to 1956 was the fact that they couldn't get the chromosomes to spread out well. And an error in a laboratory, so it's very important to own up to your errors because something good could come out of it eventually, is that somebody made up a solution that was hypotonic in the laboratory by mistake instead of an isotonic solution, was used in the preparation, and lo and behold, technically they could start counting chromosomes, and we still use a hypotonic solution in our processing. Cells are exposed to that solution for about a half an hour, 37 degrees, spun down, and then given successive washes in a fixative. So the recurring theme through all of pathology is you need to fix your material and make it permanent in some way. And the material that works best for us is 3 parts methanol, 1 part acetic acid. So that leaves us with a nice little cell pellet on the bottom of a 15 mil conical tube, which we then manually drop onto a glass slide, and it gets a little artsy because depending on the temperature and the humidity, we have better success spreading these chromosomes out. And then what we'll do is we'll go through a dip of trypsin to chew up the DNA into a little bit of a banding pattern, and then we use a Geim sustain. And if you read the literature, it's always with a capital G because it's named after Gustav Geimse, one of the famous stain makers. And here's Jim, one of our technologists in the laboratory, who's actually dropping some material onto the glass slide. And if anybody is either going to take the techniques class or if you have some time on Wednesday when we do our lecture, I can take you back into the lab and see how easy it isn't to drop a solution onto a slide that's sitting right there. Jim's like about 6'4", 6'5", so there's a lot of distance between those. It just facilitates the spreading. Here's our staining and analysis. And if you visited our laboratory 20, 25 years ago, you'd see a 35 millimeter camera sitting on top of the microscope. You photographed what you saw through the microscope. You actually counted your chromosomes through the microscope. This is 1500X, by the way. And went to the darkroom, developed your film, and then printed your pictures, and then cut them out. We had a lot of volunteers. We chained them to desks, and we got a lot of work done. But this is a little bit different now. Here's the old way. I still have some of these images in the lab if you'd like to try. It's a technique of pattern recognition. I now have a scanner. I have a second generation of this particular scanner that can actually tell the difference between a non-dividing cell and a metaphase. It captures an image for me, and we even have a little IV of oil here. Captures an image and creates a set of thumbnails. Here's a metaphase right there, a little bit more of a close-up. And then the technologist can go back to their desk, sit at their microscope if they need to review it, or most likely complete the karyotyping process right on the screen using software that can move the chromosomes around. It's nice, it's archivable, anybody needs an image for a presentation, easily dropped into a PowerPoint, as opposed to having to go re-photograph and do this all over again, has made turnaround much faster for our clinicians. Especially now with newer drugs, they need their information faster so they can start their patient on a directed therapy if they need to. So this is a beautifully G-banded, using GIMSA, karyotype. The chromosomes are organized by size, so you're going to go from the largest to the smallest. And if you notice, the bands, one chromosome inherited from mom, one from dad, do match up nicely. Those bands that are dark, that stain dark, are higher in AT content, while the light staining bands are relatively higher in GC content. So if you're a technologist, you are constantly scanning. You're looking at your landmark bands, because if you notice, some bands are darker than others. They look at the length of the chromosome, the position of that primary constriction, the centromere, to make sure it's in the right spot relative to the position of the bands. And if material is missing or rearranged, you hope to use the banding pattern as a little bit of an identification. Here's one that's a little bit longer. This is what you would achieve with a blood sample, while this is probably the best you're going to see with a bone marrow sample. The blood can be synchronized a little bit better, so you can be a little bit earlier in metaphase where the chromosome is going to be a little bit longer. When we put out our clinical reports, we estimate a haploid band resolution. This discipline, like everything else, has its own vocabulary. So if I'm going to say something is haploid, I'm talking about 23 chromosomes. 46 is diploid. So there are people who spent some time and actually counted the number of light and dark bands on the 23 chromosomes. And a preparation of this quality is about 550 bands. If you go back over here, that's about 350 to 400. So that's a form of quality assurance for us. In these sorts of laboratories, these are clinical labs that are licensed by the state to operate as a clinical lab. I have a certificate of qualification to act as a laboratory director, so there's certain requirements that you have to hit. You have to either have an MD or a PhD to be a laboratory director in these sorts of labs. Again, just as a review, the metacentric, the submetacentric, and the acrocentric chromosomes, P and Q. This is an ideogram. I can show you a lot of pictures of chromosomes. I won't show you too many, but it's nice to take a look at a standardized form of the chromosome. We actually have a nomenclature book that I can show you if you want to look through this later, and it provides us the roadmap to how to describe everything that we see. If you had the time to read any of the handout material that was sent to you, that Cytogenetics 101 covers kind of an abridged version of what we have here. We're very fortunate that cytogeneticists developed this sort of shorthand because it was easy to scan this material, computerize this material, and search this material because it was numerical. So what they did is they numbered all the bands. The numbering system gets larger as you go away from the centromere. So if I'm talking about something that is Q24, I know the band is the long arm because I just called it Q, and that 24 is going to be here, while 11.2 is going to be here. So then you can start visualizing maybe where on the chromosome that particular area of interest might be. These ideograms are provided for you just to show you how many, if you make the chromosome longer, they were drawn to scale, but if the chromosome is longer, you can see what appeared at a shorter resolution breaks up into multiple bands. So if I'm reading another laboratory's report and I see 350, I know I'm probably looking at stuff about here. But if somebody's reporting at 500, I'm over here. So that gives us an idea of what they may have seen in their sample. Now, The drawback of conventional cytogenetics, obviously, is the ability of the cell to divide and culture. We always joke that molecular biologists are our best friends. They were able to take the information that we had and put some relevance to it. I came here as a graduate student, and people were characterizing a lot of the chromosome changes in leukemias and the solid tumors. But this was before, I hate to admit, gene mapping. So people are saying, oh, that's nice. What does it mean? You know, you guys are stamp collectors. All you're doing is you're describing a lot of the things that that you see, but what's the relevance? So the molecular biologists provided the relevance, and they also provided pieces of DNA that could be tagged with different colored fluors. So that's the technique that's been around for maybe almost 20 years now, fluorescence in situ hybridization, or FISH. So when we talk about fishing, pretty much every one of our newly diagnosed patients has some FISH analysis in addition to conventional. It is not a replacement for conventional cytogenetic analysis because it's very directed study. And it very simply is that you're hybridizing a piece of fluorescently labeled nucleic acid to a target sequence. And that target sequence can be some material on a slide, most likely, and it can be material that you've already analyzed by conventional cytogenetics. We use the same material, or we can use a piece of tissue that's been sectioned by the pathologist as well. There's an advantage of being in a pathology department. We're part of pathology and laboratory medicine, and we're a subspecialty lab along with flow cytometry. Molecular diagnostics used to be part of that group, but that's been spun out as OmniSeq at this point. So we sit there and look at fluorescent images. And the processing is really quite simple. When I see you guys on Tuesday, I'll bring the catalog from one of our vendors just to give you an idea of the breadth of the probes that we have. So they're commercially available for genes of interest, 10 microliters onto a slide with a cover slip. We use these hybridization apparatus. It's a fancy hot plate. It allows the temperature to reach about 75 degrees, opens up the DNA, allows the material to hybridize. This can be done overnight, or even now it can be pushed with certain reagents to just a few hours. Washed in a couple of detergent solutions to remove any unbound probe. And this is what we see. We have anybody here who has any issues with red and green? I'm sorry. All of our probes are red and green. Oh. I always have to ask that question. Can you actually see the difference between these two colors here or no?
There's red at the end.
Yeah, there's red. Okay, just for your information, this is red and this is green. Just so that you know.
That I did not.
I'm sorry.
<It's okay. laughs>
But, you know, this is a question I have to ask a graduate student. Somebody comes in the lab and says, you know, we'd like to do this work. And it's based on the filter sets that are available to us. So what you're looking at here is an interphase nucleus. The processing that we go through in the lab strips off the cytoplasm. So all you have is the nucleus. And what you're looking at is a DAPI counter stain. So that's going to stain DNA. And this is actually going to, you know, stain your probe of interest. So what can we do? We can look for probes to the centromeric region of the chromosome, and we could use that to count how many centromeres we have. And hopefully that gives us an idea of how many chromosomes we have. And the arrows are pointing to 1, 2, 3 copies of whatever that might be. The locus-specific probes can give us information on gain or loss or rearrangement when we can see these little fusion signals. We can also get fancy and we can paint across the length of a chromosome. And there are some research-based techniques called spectrokaryotyping or SKY. That's very helpful in cell lines, by the way, because cell lines can really rearrange themselves. So what are our targets? Well, obviously we have a chromosome we can't figure out. We can apply a probe to a region that we suspect might have either moved or is present or absent. And we can visualize that on the metaphase chromosome. We can do a sequential study. We can remove the G-banding and then fish right over it. Where it really comes into play are those interphase nuclei. Because if you were to look at one of our preparations, 99% of the material that's on the slide are non-dividing cells. So there are lots of targets. We can also look at formalin fixed paraffin embedded material. So if we're doing a conventional chromosome analysis, 20 cells is a standard study. It was a statistical calculation by the guys that were doing the conventional constitutional studies, that with 95% confidence or 99% confidence that you would find what you were looking for if you did 20 cells. And the cancer people have stuck with that same standard. If we're going to be doing a fish study, we look at 200 interphase nuclei, and those can be counted pretty rapidly. So the type of material that we would normally be looking at in the lab would be bone marrow and peripheral blood, lymph nodes from our lymphoma patients, masses of tumor, a spinal fluid. We just did a spinal fluid earlier in the week on a patient, pleural fluid that might be accumulating. They would have cells that shouldn't be there. Just as I was leaving, we got a sample from Children's Hospital. We do children's material, and they sent us a sample of a Wilms tumor, or a supposed Wilms tumor. So that would be a kidney tumor, and it's a pediatric tumor. So let's move on here. Okay, so tell me what you guys see in that top image. Okay, you're now looking through the microscope and you see that. What do you see? Yeah, number of colors, number of signals.
There's three greens.
Ah, three greens, okay. And how many reds? Two reds. Yeah, you know, sometimes it's the way they photograph, but basically you have... it's nicer on my screen, by the way. Two aquas, one, two, three greens, and two reds. So you need to know what you would expect to see. So if I'm going to study, let's say, chromosome 12, how many copies of chromosome 12 would you expect to find in the cell? Two. You expect to find two of everybody except for the X and the Y. So if I were to look at a group of centromeres, my expected signal pattern probably would be two of everything. So this is telling me that there's an abnormality. I need to know what I tagged the green probe with in order to, you know, determine probably chromosome 12 in this case. There are some other probe configurations that they're set up in such a way that we call them break-apart probes, because there may be rearrangements with multiple chromosomes. And what they do is it's set up in such a way that the 5' end might be green, the 3' end might be in red. And if a rearrangement takes place, the colors split apart. So by definition, we have a break-apart probe. And that's exactly what we use for the immunoglobulin gene, because there are a lot of different rearrangements or translocations involving the immunoglobulin gene. And it gets a little dicey. We always have these issues with the immunoglobulin genes because sometimes the signals, instead of being tight, red and green together, there's sometimes a little bit of a distance between them. And then the question is, did it break apart or is it just hanging together? And that has to do with the presence of the variable region. And it varies in size for some individuals. We can also paint. This is a paint for chromosome 1. So there's two copies of chromosome 1, and there is additional chromosome 1 material parked on this other chromosome. So we're always looking for imbalances, gains and losses, and rearrangements. The SCI procedure is pretty slick. It requires a very fancy set of filters and a microscope and a very nice computer that will artificially assign a color to each chromosome. So you have 24 different colors. And that can be achieved by mixing as few as 2, 4, 6 different colors in different combinations. Obviously, you buy this from the vendor, but the chromosome color is assigned by the computer. And the program is kind of slick because you can hover over a region on the computer and it'll tell you what chromosome it came from. But the level of resolution isn't that great. I mean, this is how you don't see this through the microscope. Your eye can't see all these changes. But you can see that on the computer screen. And I think if you squint, because I'm a little bit close to it, you can see there's material. The chromosome should be all the same color. So this tells you... Yeah, that's exactly what it is. But with the small chromosomes and small pieces, sometimes you get bleeding of some of the floors, so it's sometimes difficult to see what's going on. But it's a great help for cell lines, even with some limitations. And here's an example where it would show, just look like here, 7, 16, 16, 7, 5, 16, 5, 17. It would be tough, especially for the smaller segments, to just eyeball it by a banding pattern. What it can't tell you is if material inverts, because you have the same material on the chromosome, you've just rearranged it. This is just tagging the material from that chromosome, so it does have some limitations. So we have some pluses and minuses of these techniques. Cytogenetics really has a low sensitivity. Our sensitivity is about equivalent to that of the hematopathologist. It's not as sensitive as flow cytometry and definitely not as sensitive as molecular diagnostics. One of the strong points, of course, is that you can see clonal evolution or changes that are occurring on a cell-by-cell basis. We need fresh samples. They need to be dividing. And if you notice, heavy reliance on technicians' experience is not an understatement. I have people who have 25 plus years of experience, so they've seen a lot of different abnormalities. Fish is nice, it's easier. You can not exactly use it for minimal residual disease purposes, but you can see an abnormality that might be present in a cell culture that isn't in division, and you don't need anything fresh. The big minus for fish is that you only can answer the question that you asked. How many copies of the centromere of chromosome 12 do I have? How many copies of the centromere of chromosome 8? Do I have a deletion of chromosome 5? Do I have a deletion of chromosome 7? I could be asking the 5 and 7 question, but I could have an extra copy of chromosome 8 in those cells, and I wouldn't know that unless I did conventional cytogenetics. But they're good together. This is the oncology course on a slide, by the way. A little simplistic these days, but still kind of works. And this is kind of the lead into the abnormalities that we might be seeing. We're basically categorizing mutations in the genome of somatic cells. And based on what you learned last semester, you know that damage can occur through exposure to environmental factors. And those factors could be either chemicals, radiation, or viruses. Or as we jokingly say, you could inherit your parents poorly. And as a result, you're going to have issues relating to oncogenes, apoptosis, tumor suppressor genes. You've got altered regulatory and gene products. You're going to get an expansion of an abnormal cell population. You're going to pick up additional mutations. It's going to lead to tumor heterogeneity and then our malignant neoplasm. I'm going to bring this book in with me on Tuesday. This is the most recent WHO classification book. The World Health Organization classifies all different kinds of cancers. And this is used worldwide because it's really important for communication as well as for patient treatment that everybody is calling a disease state by the same way. And the hematopathologists were really the first to appreciate the information that cytogenetics could provide to them. because there are certain chromosomal abnormalities that are very tightly associated now with a particular type of leukemia and actually defines that leukemia. And they have rules. You can't, they look at images.